It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Hey, everybody, this is Caffeinated Comics, and I am John Clark. We're going to have another Skype show today, so I'm in the studio alone. This is a really exciting one for me. As most of you guys know, I've been a Batman fan since I was a little kid in the 70s watching reruns of the Adam West show. And I stuck with it when I discovered Dark Knight Returns. I came back, again, huge Batman fan. But my peak period, I would say, are the 1990s, when Bruce Timm was doing the animated series, Tim Burton was making the movies, and Denny O'Neil was running DC Comics. There were amazing stories being put out then. You had Kelly Jones drawing Batman for a long time. You had Nightfall. You had Cataclysm. You had No Man's Land in the end of the 90s. Just amazing stories. But through it all, there was Chuck Dixon. And Chuck Dixon was writing Detective Comics, Nightwing, Robin, and Birds of Prey all at the same time. He had a terse style that I really gravitated towards. He was down to earth. He didn't do a lot of superpowered craziness. It was mostly gangster stories. And even when the supervillains came in, it was straight, gritty crime drama. And I couldn't get enough of it. His run with Graham Nolan was one of my favorite Batman runs ever. When I started rebuying back issues a couple of years ago, it was because I found his issues for a really good price. So I've been talking to him on Facebook for a while, and he's been a really good guy, but I was always intimidated to ask him to come on. And he's one of my heroes in comic writing. But when he said he had a new project, I was really interested, and as soon as I asked him, he agreed, and he actually came on sooner than I expected. I figured we'd go a couple weeks and find a date. 2 days later, we were talking on Skype. We had a great conversation. It ended up being an entire hour, so what I thought was a segment is going to be an episode. So without further ado, I'll just run into my conversation with Chuck Dixon. I want to begin by saying you totally threw off my opener. Because I was sitting thinking when we were just talking about having this discussion, I was like, Chuck Dixon he's very tough. He always writes tough guys. You know, he's very terse. The language is very sharp. It's very quick sentences. It's like the Elmore Leonard of comics. You know, your Batman was very down to earth. Not a lot of superpowers. More of a procedural. And a lot of military books, and then you go on Facebook and say you're writing SpongeBob. Now I don't know what to say to you.
Well, yeah, he's tough.
He is not tough.
He's absorbent.
Squidward is tough. Mr. Krabs is tough.
Yeah, Mr. Krabs is tough.
So what are you working on? Are you working on the comic right now?
Yeah, I've done a few stories for them. Chris Duffy is the editor on the book, and he used to be at DC and a real good guy. And when they decided to launch their own comic, he thought of me. Steve Hillenburg had a sweet deal when he signed with Nickelodeon. He kept all the comic book rights to himself.
Oh, that's amazing. And that show is the only show on Nickelodeon that's been in productions. It's now going on like 15 years.
Yeah, and the cool thing is, I mean, SpongeBob the comic is actually a creator-owned comic. I mean,
oh, really? So it's his comic.
It's his comic. He does what he wants with it. He hired Chris, and it's cool because he sees all the stories, and so you're dealing with the creator, you know, and he bounces ideas back. And this is maybe the sixth story I've done with him. I have a Mermaid Man story coming up, drawn by Ramona Fraiden, the
really
age Aquaman artist. So,
oh, that's wow. Really cool. Yeah, I always think of Ramona Fraiden from with Metamorpho.
Yeah.
It's synonymous with it. So how do you block out a SpongeBob story as opposed to like an episode? Are you doing like 11-page stories, or they're self-contained?
They either run 1 page, 4 pages, or 10 pages. I came up with a basic concept. And called Chris, and he says, "Well, is it 4 or 10?" And I said, "Well, let's go 4, because you have guys that can actually fit a lot of panels on a page and not make it look cramped." So, mm-hmm. I actually, you know, started and finished it. I pitched it, started it, and finished it today. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm all done.
So they're so they're basically sketches where you're throwing out a premise and then playing jokes off that, and then you're out?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was like a two-sentence pitch. I pitched it as a very special SpongeBob. SpongeBob is concerned that Patrick has made new friends who only befriended him because he's stupid, and he makes them laugh, and he does everything to try to protect Patrick from being hurt.
Yeah, that sounds that sounds awesome. So again,
but of course, he got it all wrong. So,
but now, is it written in your style? Is it a lot of SpongeBob first person narration in captions?
I actually did that with a Sandy, the little squirrel. I did a first person one where she's narrating the story, and then Patrick comes in and narrates the story. But I did it Kirby style, where they have little heads at the top of the panel.
Oh, cool! Do they have flat fingers? Because we're
and Patrick just sort of interrupts her halfway through the story and starts narrating it himself.
I didn't take it. The plot goes off the rails at that moment.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, every SpongeBob plot should go off the rails.
Yeah,
that's the point of the show.
Yeah, it's amazing that it's lasted this long. I mean, we've I was on constantly when my son was younger, and he still likes it. And now my second son is coming along, so I think I'm just gonna be watching SpongeBob for about as long as it's been in production.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I mean, my boys, they still watch it every once in a while. They grew up watching it. And it was one of the shows I didn't mind watching it with.
No, well, it's good.
It was funny, and some of the stories are actually rather sophisticated. So
yeah, I was shocked because it's probably more information about me than everybody wants to talk to you. But I was working at the Museum of Television and Radio the year it premiered, and we had the main exhibit was Nickelodeon. And I remember we would see the clips, and I was like, okay, this is their Ren and Stimpy. This is their really weird cartoon that college kids are into and doesn't last that long. And now it's 15 years, and it's Sesame Street at this point.
Yeah, when I first heard the concept, I was like, yeah, that won't last. And I said that about Ninja Turtles, too. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, well, that's a dumb idea.
Ninja Turtles is now on its fourth series.
Yeah. Yeah, and movies and the toys have come back how many times? Three times?
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, my son is obsessed with Ninja Turtles now.
Yeah.
But luckily, the new series is actually really good.
It's a great franchise.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those you don't get when you first see it, unless you're a kid.
Right, yeah, it seems more shallow than it is.
Yeah.
But, so going back to your style, it's so signature. Is that something that just naturally came from you, or were you going for something? Who were your influences, especially getting into comics?
My biggest comic influence has to be Archie Goodwin. When I was a kid, he was doing those black and white horror magazines for Warren. They had just started, and he just seemed to balance words and pictures perfectly. I mean, he tailored his stories toward the artist, and then he got out of the way. So I kind of learned the invisible hand style of writing that I use from him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And who did you read growing up? Who really hit you as a kid?
Stan Lee.
Well, yeah.
He was everywhere.
It's like saying you're into the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
Stan Lee.
He influenced everybody. But, of course, he was that was Kirby influencing me as well, through Stan. Because, I got to work with Stan recently, And by actually working with him and seeing his process, I realized that his process evolved through Kirby, because his writing pre-Kirby was not the same as it was after Kirby. So they kind of, learn from each other.
And how was he to work with? Does he ever calm down?
No.
Was it just 12 hours of Chuck, I got something for you?
He's always at 11, and somebody said to me, Stan's getting old, he can't remember people's names. I said, he could never remember people's names. That's what Fearless Faithful One was all about, so he could pretend he remembered you. But, he was fun to work with, very energetic, and, he's still got it, as far as comics go.
Yeah, he's just a pleasure to see, every time you see any appearance of him, it's always just full. He's really managed to make himself an icon.
Yeah, I mean, he wedded himself to Marvel Comics in a marketing way that worked. I mean, I didn't see it as ego-driven. I thought that, when I was a kid, I really thought Stan was talking to me.
Yeah, me too.
Writing a comic, you know, and it was very personalized, and that's really what put Marvel over the top for me, you know, other than the fact that the stories were more sophisticated and interesting than what was going on at DC at the time. But, you know, he really did reach out. It was an intimate sort of thing, and it worked for everybody.
Yeah, and it still does. I mean, just the word Stanley presents and all the cameos he's making now.
I mean, you know, he's a personable guy. He had the gift of gab, and you know, for my money, he saved comics, and he desperately wanted to save his job. So you know, the whole Marvel thing was just a last minute ploy. I mean, I've talked to guys who were there at the time when it looked like the end. But you know, him, you know, he told one artist I met, you know, Jack, Steve, and Don and I are going to try something.
That not the opening to a Marvel Comics history?
Yeah, seriously.
That should be the first line of the prologue.
Yeah, he was letting Gene Colan go and said, "I don't have any more work for you, but Jack, Steve, and Don and I are going to try something."
Wow. Yeah, and then Gene came back.
Yeah, then Gene came back as Adam Austin. He couldn't use his real name.
Well, speaking of the movies, I've been wondering this for a while. How did you feel about Tom Hardy in Dark Knight Rises?
Well, for a guy that could only use the top half of his face, I think he did a great job.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bravura performance, but it's so removed from the character that you created.
Yeah, I mean, except for the, you know, they got the ominous part right, you know, and how threatening and dangerous he was. And my only disappointment was, he wasn't the mastermind behind it all, as it turned out. But, when you can't have everything.
Yeah, and you know, you did get to see him in Batman and Robin.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and that was, you know, well, whatever.
It's hard.
My favorite version is the animated version, especially his first appearance when Henry Silva does his voice.
Oh, really? That's interesting, because I had heard that Bruce Timm, at the time, they didn't take the character as seriously in that first appearance. And then they changed him dramatically for the new Batman adventures.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but you know, I was generally pleased. That sort of middle series they did where there's that horrific Batgirl dream sequence with Bane in it. I mean, that was really effective.
Oh, yeah, right. That's a Paul Dini episode, too. It was probably the most chilling of everything they did.
Yeah, it was great because he was, you know, at the center of it all. So, I mean, you know, I can't kick. You know, there's not much you can do about it. You know, these things are out there. You know, it's like letting your children go with other parents. You know,
right. Well, also, you got to contribute a villain who's now A-list. You know, when you think about every writer who comes on Batman tries their hand at their own villain, and you were given pretty much an unenviable position where you had to create Batman's Doomsday. And we're at a point now where more people talk about Bane than talk about Doomsday. So, you're an overachiever there.
Yeah. I mean, he became a household name. I mean, they make, you know, he's a punchline in late night comics jokes. And
right.
Everybody knows who he is. And, you know, that's cool. I mean, that's rare because, you know, the list of, you know, Batman's, you know, iconic rose gallery is you know, it's like a half dozen characters, and Bane's in there with them.
Yeah, we were saying on, I think on one of the episodes, or maybe off the air, that after that initial golden age where you get everybody, Joker, Penguin, Catwoman, Scarecrow, Two-Face, you get really one major villain every decade.
Right.
You know, you have Poison Ivy in the 60s, Ra's al Ghul in the 70s, Killer Croc in the 80s, and it's Bane in the 90s.
Yeah. Although I really love Ventriloquist,
Ventriloquist is cool, but he's like he's head of the minor league.
Yeah, and really, it's most of the iconic villains, you know, from the Golden Age, you know, except for Joker and Penguin, were basically rescued by the Adam West TV show. I mean, Riddler was forgotten, and Catwoman really didn't have a story. You know, and Mr. Freeze was pretty much forgotten.
Yeah, I always wondered why Two-Face never appeared on the Adam West show. It seemed like such an easy makeup to do. But maybe he was just too far buried at that point.
Yeah, I think they thought that it was too horrific, is my understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, and
he wouldn't be funny, you know, because he's actually disfigured.
Yeah, I always wanted Sid Caesar to be Two-Face.
then he could jump from left and right.
That would have been cool.
He would have made it work.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And talk in different accents.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Yeah, but so how much of Bane was yours and Graham's, and how much came out of the room? Because the Venom came from an earlier Denny story, and Santa Prisca had been in the DC universe. Were those right. things that were handed to you in the room, or did you say, I'm going to pull from this and pull from this?
Well, Venom was going to have to be part of it. And then when I brought up, you know, hey, he's raised from birth in a prison, you know, in some banana republic hellhole, Denny said, well, why don't you use Santa Prisca since it's been established and tied to Venom already? And I thought, well, perfect. He'll be, you know, a Venom experiment. You know, but the meeting we had sort of a mini summit, because we started out in Nightfall without a villain. There was a placeholder. You know, it was like new villain here.
But and at that point, did you know that just Bruce Wayne was going away, or?
Yeah, well, we knew the whole. Denny laid out like the whole 2 year thing. His back broken, he'd be going away. He'd be replaced by another guy, and you know, that wouldn't work out, and blah blah blah. And you know, but we had this villain who was going to disable Bruce, and he was just sort of like, well, we'll figure him out later. And we had like a mini summit to talk about this villain. And I made a big deal about how, you know, he's going to have to be popular, and it's really hard to create a popular character, you know, with the idea in mind he's going to be popular. You know,
right, it's like creating a viral...
on your face.
It's so like creating a viral video today.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, the readers can smell desperation, and this is going to be difficult. And Denny basically said, well, since you think it's going to be so hard, then you do it. So I guess he thought, well, I was really going to sweat it, which I did, you know, and... but, you know, we had Gibbons, like, you know, he had to be the physical and intellectual equal to Batman. Otherwise, you know, we didn't want some punk breaking Batman's back. So, and then the addition of Venom was perfect, because then Venom was his weakness.
Right, as well as his strength.
It enhanced him, but it also, it messed up his judgment, and so that ultimately he could be defeated.
Right. That's right. And there was no talk about that one of the established villains might have been able to do this? Because that's a thing where, at the time, everyone was excited to see a new villain. But looking back, I read articles, especially about Superman, of, you know, why is it Doomsday that kills Superman, this brand new character, and not Lex Luthor finally getting the upper hand? Was that ever a discussion? Or was it, let's create a new character and that'll be part of the buzz?
Yeah, you know, Denny's philosophy was, if you're going to, and I think it's a great philosophy, was if you're going to do a big event that hopefully will draw in lots of new readers, then create a new villain that go with it. Because then, the coming out the other side, you might end up with a decent villain you can keep using. And in this case, it worked.
Right, yeah, it worked really well.
But, you know, I went on a villain creating rampage while at DC, and I never had one stick except for me.
I'm trying to remember who were some of the other ones in your run, because your detective run, especially with Graham, it was most of the 90s, and then if you add up Nightwing and Robin and Birds of Prey and Batgirl, how many issues did you write of Batman, including
the detective? I wrote 85 issues of Detective.
Okay.
And you know, 100 of Robin, plus the miniseries and annuals and specials and all that stuff. So, yeah, I tend to, well, you know, back then you could stay on a book, you know, as long as the sales didn't dip.
Right, they weren't rebooting the numbering every 2 years.
Yeah, yeah, and they weren't replacing the writers after 2 issues. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I just stayed on until the wheels came off.
Right. And to spend that long on a character who shared, you know, it's not like, say, Peter David's run on the Hulk, he's, for the most part, left alone. How did that feel when you get to year 7, year 8, year 9 on these characters, and you're not in a universe that you completely control? But does it get harder to come up with stories, or are you coming up with stories that aren't mixing as well? How did you keep it interesting?
I don't know. It just sort of organically happened, because, you know, you build a supporting cast and things kind of grow out of that. And then, you know, if we needed a change, you know, like on Robin, we sent him to boarding school because it made for a little bit of a different setting, you know, for a year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were story reasons to do that. And, you know, just, you know, Dick Grayson becoming a cop, You know, things like that, just to shake it up, but not break it. You know, just little changes, so you can come up with different scenarios and introduce new supporting characters. But you know, I was doing between Batman Nightwing or Detective Nightwing, Robin, and Birds of Prey. I was doing four of the books, so I kind of had a mini Bat universe of my own because I did a lot of crossovers, you know, between my own books.
Right, and at that point, that's the majority of the line for Batman, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I was writing over half the Bat-related books at one time for, you know, a couple of years there.
Yeah. And was that all still coordinated through Denny, or did you kind of feel like you owned the universe at that point?
Well, it was Denny and Scott Peterson and Jordan Gorfinkel were the main editors. And, you know, they worked close together, and they all shared the same philosophy on Batman. And, you know, if I had any questions, you know, I doubted Denny's judgment on things. But, you know, I was, for the most part, was left alone. I wrote one story they absolutely hated, but at least they let me finish it and then told me how much they hated it. But
what was that? Can you do you want to say or
no? I'll tell you.
Go ahead.
We created this character. Well, we didn't create him. We brought back the character Captain Fear, and so we made a pirate themed Batman villain. And Graham and I thought it was our ultimate Batman story because it had everything in it. It had a themed villain. It had a clever crime, and it ends with a trap that Batman supposedly is not going to be able to escape from. So for us, it was like the perfect Batman story, and they hated it. They thought it was corny, and, you know, they didn't like the pirate villain, even though we made fun of him. His own henchmen would make fun of him behind his back. So, but they just didn't care for it. It wasn't grim enough or something, which I don't know how it wasn't grim enough that the trap is Batman tied to a buoy in Gotham Harbor surrounded by sharks. I mean, you know, but it wasn't grim enough.
Yeah, I remember the cover of that. So Captain Fear was your anti-Bane.
Yeah. Right. And the thing is, we were going to build to a whole thing. I don't know how much you follow the series, but
I do have every issue. I didn't want to geek out on you.
Well, I don't know if Bruce had this obnoxious neighbor, J. Devlin Davenport.
I remember,
just annoy the hell out of him at every opportunity. And Graham and I built this whole thing where we were going to have Captain Fear return and then reveal that he is J. Devlin Davenport. He was Bruce's next door neighbor. And but you know, they said never use this guy again.
Did that include the neighbor?
No, we had a neighbor, but he didn't have a story anymore, so I just sort of phased him out because there was nowhere to go with him.
Right. So what would you say out of the whole run? What are you most proud of? Obviously, Captain Fear is not the number one.
Oh, no, no.
Is there a particular story or a run that you felt like was really the peak of that era for you? Or
I got to do two good Riddler stories, and they're not easy to write. And I was real, because he's like my favorite Bat villain, and I got to write what I felt were two classic Riddler stories that used, you know, his modus operandi in a clever way. And you know, the one of them, it literally took 2 years to plot. Just kept going back to it, make sure all the riddles worked and all that stuff. And then the other thing I'm proud of, but a lot of fans hate me for, is Detective Zero, in which we find out that Joe Chill was not the man who killed Bruce's parents, and that Bruce never would know who that was.
Oh, yeah, that was a long-running debate. I had forgotten where that came from.
Yeah, it was mentioned on Big Bang Theory. That's probably what I went.
Oh, really? I remember it resurfacing in Jeff Loeb's Superman Batman that it's mentioned, and I had forgotten your Zero issue. The one thing I really remembered from those Zero issues, which I loved, and if it's yours, you can take credit for it, is that Bruce tried to join the FBI before he became Batman, and then he realized how much paperwork it would be. And
yeah, I think that was actually established by Denny in Denny's first Legend of the Dark Knight.
Oh, really? In the first issue?
Yeah.
That first story?
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved that idea that there was a moment where Bruce would have done it a normal way. And
right.
Then he's like, well, this is not crazy enough for me.
Yeah, he's not expedient enough.
He's like, I'm not walking through a metal detector every day. What I need is a cape.
He only wanted to work nights. That was the problem.
Yeah. My ideal of Batman is somebody who's 85% normal. Because
right.
If he was really crazy, he wouldn't be able to do any detective work. But
Yeah,
he just goes to the end of logic, and instead of making a left, he makes a right.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to just catch criminals. I'm going to scare the crap out of them as well.
Yeah, and I'm going to run around the streets every single night in this outfit. And, you know, if there's no crimes happening, I'm just going to run around the city in this outfit. And I'm going to convince a couple of kids to run around in different outfits. And when they question me, I'm going to cut them out of my life.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah, that's why we love him.
Oh, yeah, that, man.
You know what? I don't think you dealt with this directly, but I've always wanted an answer for this. And it's just always driven me crazy. Was it during the 90s where... did you guys really deal with Batman as the urban legend that no one knew he existed?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Why was he in the frickin' Justice League?
Well, that, you know, there was this whole personality thing, and you know, Denny's thing was to just simply ignore all that.
Right.
Like that, you know, to us, that wasn't happening. That was a movie made on another planet.
It made me so nuts. Because even when Grant Morrison was writing it, at the end of every Justice League story is them giving a press conference to every major media outlet. And the way they would solve it is Batman was turned 90 degrees away from the camera.
Yeah. It's like, well, who's that guy? Well, don't worry about him.
Because he doesn't exist.
Well, I mean, the only time I found that frustrating was we did this arc, Cataclysm, where, you know, Gotham City...
Oh, yeah, the earthquake.
Yeah, Gotham City just kind of falls down in an earthquake. And Wayne Manor takes a hit, you know, it collapses. And the problem came up, well, how do you rebuild Wayne Manor atop the Batcave? And I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if they built Wayne Manor in another place and then moved it? And so I had a story where Bruce goes to Superman. Bruce goes to Superman and says, can you move my house?
That's awesome.
And then he hated the idea because it included Superman. So I said, well, what if it's just he goes to meet Clark and it's never even seen? And then one day, all of a sudden, Wayne Manor is back in place. Mm-hmm. And he still didn't like the idea. So.
Yeah, that must be a fine line to walk because the Bat universe is so on itself. It's pretty inclusive, and there's only so far you can push it. There's characters like Clayface and Mr. Freeze and Man-Bat right. that almost have superpowers, but they're still restrained. But then the fact that he lives in the DC universe.
Yeah, well, I mean, Clayface, Man-Bat, Mr. Freeze, they're science fiction characters, but that's fine, you know, because at least it's got some science base, and it's also a horror base, and Batman is deeply
right.
steeped in a sort of a horror theme. So that's excusable, but, you know, when you start introducing, you know, magic and aliens and things like that, then, like, this does not fit.
Yeah, it's a very fine line. It must have been hard to find it when you're in the middle of a page.
Yeah, and I think that's why we went for the whole urban legend thing, because it kind of added a feel to it that made it more believable. We also had things I don't think were ever stated in the book, that Gotham was in the middle of, like, population depression like New York had in the 70s, where it was a city for 15 million, but now only 7 million live there.
And yeah, everybody was leaving.
Yeah, that explained why the Batmobile, you know, never got stuck in traffic.
And I
used to think too hard about this stuff because we always discuss if we want to bring back the Bat plane, and I said, that's ridiculous. Where are you going to land a plane and nobody's going to see it? All you have to do is follow it back. It has to land sometime. You know, a car, yeah. You know, you can get away with a car, but not with a plane.
Yeah, that was one of the...
That's why Graham and I created the subway rocket, because that's something he could, you know, get anywhere in the city without being seen.
The subway rocket was cool. But that was one of the complaints with Dark Knight Rises, where he had the Bat plane and he just threw a tent over it and left.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, if that makes sense.
None of Bane's men went up to that building ever. The whole city's under lockdown, but nobody went up to this building. Because, you know, that would have been a nice twist if Batman comes back and the plane's gone, and then Bane's flying the plane and shooting at him. I found your plane.
I think that the first Tim Burton movie, you know, he gets in that bat plane and he flies for, what, 5 minutes?
Yeah, and then Jack Nicholson kills it with a pistol.
Yeah, shoots it down with one shot.
Yeah, well, he also had machine guns and missiles.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
But he wasn't going to kill anybody.
No. In fact, I explained that. We were watching Batman Returns. My son's six now, so he's just at the right superhero age.
Right.
So we showed him Beetlejuice, and he got really into Tim Burton, and then we put on Batman Returns. And my wife's like, "Oh, what's with all the guns in the Batmobile?" I'm like, "It's property damage. He's got to blow up a wall. In case that wall comes up, he's not going to shoot it at anybody."
Yeah, it's all just effect.
Yeah. But, you know, it's great to hear that it sounds like you really still have the love for the character. You didn't get burned out. You don't sound like you ran out of ideas. It seems like that's a part of your career that you still have a fondness for.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was such a huge Batman fan when I was a kid. And I still can't believe I got to write it and got to write it as long as I did. I mean, I never even tried out for Batman. Danny sort of reached out for me to do the Robin miniseries, and then I, you know, sort of fell into it.
Any characters of Marvel and DC you've always wanted to do that you just never got the chance?
I always wanted to do the Fantastic Four.
Me too.
I wouldn't mind a shot at Superman.
Yeah, I feel like everybody's got one Superman story in them. It seems like doing a run would be much harder than doing like a 48-page prestige for him.
Yeah, yeah. It's always harder to write less. I tend to like to settle in, you know, and get in with the ensemble and, you know, mess around.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I love about the long runs, which as you said, you don't find anymore. I mean, people now talk about how long Jonathan Hickman's run was on Fantastic Four, and it was 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, or Mark Waid's leaving Daredevil now, and people are saying it's a huge run, and it's, you know, 30 issues. We're in this age now where it feels like comics have gotten so close to movies that the stories have to be complete in and of themselves. We don't have that rolling continuity that we used to, where the next writer just steps into the plot line of the old writer, and you just keep that train running.
Yeah, comics are becoming more like Hollywood in every negative aspect.
No positives?
No. The pitch process takes forever. It didn't used to. It used to be, hey, how about this guy and this guy fight? Great. And you go to work. And now it's, you know, well, what about this? How's it going to impact that? And then meeting after meeting. And then you find out, you know, you read on the web that you're not the writer anymore. And then, you know, there's a whole post-production process in comics that didn't used to exist because the computers allow them to mess with stuff after the artwork's done, and it just seems to be ridiculous. You know, the greatest thing about comics is it's such a seat-of-the-pants medium. It's drawn on paper, for God's sakes. Well, it used to be.
Yeah, it used to be. When paper was affordable.
Yeah. I mean, it's a guy who writes and a guy who draws, and they come up with a story, and now it's, you know, it's some other process that I don't quite understand.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, comics were founded by guys who felt they weren't good enough to get into newspapers. And now we're at this level where you don't just aspire to comics. They put themselves on this pedestal for good or for ill.
Yeah, and you got a lot of guys who, you know, they'll come out of Hollywood and slum in comics for a while. I call them tourists. and then you got guys. I mean, I look at previews and I see names, and they're there for a while, and then they vanish. And you know, writers, you just never see their names again. That never used to happen. You know, they were guys like me. Once you got into comics, you were like a parasite. You burrowed in and you never leave. And you've got guys who will come in and do two miniseries and then go back to writing, you know, for the CW and never be heard of again.
Right. Yeah. But you're not seeing the alternate happen that much. You're not seeing a guy write comics and then become a screenwriter in the way that you know, there's artists that become storyboard artists. You're not seeing people graduate. You're just seeing people come down, and that's interesting.
Well, if you're a comic book guy, you go to Hollywood and they think, oh, well, he's cheap. We can get him for nothing.
Yeah,
you know, and that's the problem.
Yeah, I actually read. You don't have to tell the story again, but I read an interview where you were talking about Expendables 2, and you said that was basically what it came down to.
Yeah, they just thought this guy's cheap. You know, he's never written a movie before. And it's like, yeah, but I've written.
I know what that's worth.
I mean, why am I here if you weren't interested? As a guy told me recently, I started a project, and then they decided to bring in another writer. And he said, yeah, you were a genius the other day. Now you're no good.
Yeah. I was just reading today that they brought in Lawrence Kasdan to rewrite the next Star Wars, which they were glowing about Michael Arndt's screenplay. And it seems like on features, you just do it to do it. Instead of calling the guy back to do another draft, you just hire a new guy.
Oh, no, yeah. You don't say, hey, this is what we were looking for, like an editor would on a book, and say, you know, hey, could you punch this up? No, they just, you're done. You don't understand this, and they just give it to another guy. And the other guys they give it to sometimes don't make any sense. I mean, Kasdan, yeah, makes sense. He's obviously familiar with the material.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, he's written.
You'll bring in writers. You know, this guy did an off-Broadway play, or he wrote a great novel about women's suffrage. Yeah, let's put him on this dinosaur movie. You know, I was like, well, why him?
Yeah,
I always hear the story about, you know, this guy, we're holding this property for this guy, and he'll be able to start writing it in a year, and it's going to take a year and a half for him to write it. And then, you know, 3 years later, the movie comes out, and you go, this is what they waited for?
Yeah. I think the system in Hollywood, just in and of itself, not even talking about comic writers or playwriters, it seems that it started to break down when TV got good. Because it used to be a guy got into the writer's room on a show and learned how to do story, learned how to write screenplays on a show, and then got big enough, ran his own shows, and then started writing movies. And it seems like these guys that would right now be, say, the eighth guy in the room on Justified, now they're writing the second draft of a feature that no one's going to see, and their name's not going to be on the picture.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, and all the invisible hands, you know, writing behind the scenes who don't, you know, they don't get credit.
Yeah, which is insane. I think, you know.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that process as long as you have leadership at the top. I mean, Howard Hawks worked that way and did some fantastic movies with 16 writers and only two of them getting credit. Mm-hmm. But that's fine as long as there's this energetic creative process. But when it's just switching guys out because, well, we need a laugh in this scene, so let's bring in a new guy. I always use the example that the Flintstones movie had 32 writers, and the only things that were funny in it were two ad-libs by Jonathan Winters.
Yeah.
So
that managed to be less funny than the original cartoon.
Yeah, which that's a job in itself.
Yeah. It's like M. Night Shyamalan's Avatar.
Yeah.
You adapted this great thing and managed to miss everything that was great in it. That's almost commendable, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes a lot of work. Well, you know, it's like, how do you screw up a Lone Ranger movie?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, apparently they figured a way.
Yeah, $300 million, and they did it.
Yeah, it was one of those where I was very excited to go until that weekend. And then, my son still mentions it because he's a big fan of Pirates of the Caribbean, and he loves Cowboys. So, and I made the mistake of pumping him up when we saw the trailer. You want to see this? Yeah! And then it came out, and he's like, hey, let's go see that. And I'm like, look, SpongeBob is on. But I read one review that said, it is both boring and too violent for children. So the only time children are paying attention to the screen is when they're crying.
Yeah, that was a mess. That's like the perfect example. And then, you know, it's also an example of why Hollywood's changed now, where they're terrified of making a movie now. So,
yeah, well, it's amazing too with the superhero genre. I mean, when we got to the, I remember seeing, you know, last year was Avengers and Dark Knight Rises, and I actually thought for a minute, seeing both of them, I was like, well, we know how to do this now. We've done 10 of them, and they're getting better and better. We're not going to mess this up anymore. Yeah, and then obviously we have again and again.
Yeah, I mean, now that it's just a genre and they're not looking at it as anything particularly special, you know, we're going to see really rotten superhero movies. And then they make other. I mean, the last Star Trek movie was a superhero movie. It's like now they're stuck.
Yeah.
You know, the gear is stuck in superhero, and everything has to look like a superhero movie.
Yeah, which is a shame because. As much as I love that first Star Trek, it seemed like that second one forgot what Star Trek was. And was just
they
have t-shirts and bell bottoms, make them run.
They consciously took the Star Trek out of it. They said, well, these are the things that people don't like about Star Trek, so let's leave all that behind. Yeah, but the first 30 minutes is Starfleet politics? I mean, snore.
Right, and there was...
You leave that in, Yeah, but you take out, you know, the repartee and things like that.
It was interesting because I saw it with my co-host and one of our frequent panelists, and they're both guys in their 20s. So we all went to see it together. We review it on the podcast. And then I said, well, you know, the whole thing was trying to be Wrath of Khan without being Wrath of Khan. And neither of them had seen Wrath of Khan. And then so I said, well, let's leave the studio and go to the living room and order a pizza. At the end of that, they both went, that was so much better. And now I understand what Star Trek Into Darkness was trying to do.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe trying to do. I can't see where they tried.
Yeah. And then the other thing that really hit me after watching Wrath of Khan again, there was no central sci-fi idea in that. Other than, like, we can teleport really far.
Right.
Wrath of Khan is, you know, this huge revenge story, but it also has the Genesis device at the center of it. It has this really big, hard sci-fi idea. And even that was missing.
But, you know, and Wrath of Khan had the ups and downs of the storyline.
Yeah.
I mean, you really did think, okay, they're finished now.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way out of this. And then not only is there a way out of it, it's brilliant.
Yep.
You know, totally turns the tables, and that happens like 3 times in the movie. And it's like, that's great stuff. That'd be great stuff in any kind of movie.
Yeah, even in the second one where they're just sitting around the cave, and you're like, I don't know how they're getting out of this cave. They're not even in danger now, but they're just stuck.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do something that's unexpected and perfectly in character.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, logically, the movie's seamless.
Yeah. Yeah.
And more resonant. I mean, when Khan is revealed to be Khan, it's a hell of a moment. And in the remake, it isn't.
Yeah, and they had that whole, you know, it was all PR marketing. Oh, he is, but he isn't, but he is, but he isn't. And that's the thing. When he says Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness, there is this pause because they're waiting for the audience to go, ooh. But the characters don't know who that is, so they have to call old Spock and ask him who he is.
Old Spock, he thumbs through a TV guide.
Yeah.
And he's, here it is.
Old Spock
Thursday
is
Thursday night at 9.
Old Spock is Wikipedia on that ship.
It's like, you know, he did everything but, you know, name the episode.
1966, Ricardo Montalban, was before Fantasy Island.
Yeah, it was Space Seed. Yeah, that was it. I remember.
That was a good one. The director was Mark Daniels. He was very good. Yeah, it does amaze me. This summer was a summer of disappointment, where so many of these movies, they would work and then they would just trip over their own feet.
Yeah,
it happened time and time again. And I found my favorite film of my favorite film of the big movies was Iron Man 3, because I was fine with the turn that made many people angry. But then my favorite film of the summer was World's End, and it didn't do well. You know, we didn't have that Avengers summer where people really swelled up, and it's just so hard to do when you have to filter it through.
Yeah, I you know, it was not a good summer, but what was the movie you just mentioned? Not the World's End was
Iron Man 3.
Iron Man 3. I thought Iron Man 3, I mean, you know, it's Shane Black. It's a hell of a Shane Black movie.
Yeah.
I didn't see where it violated the formula to the degree I don't want to see formula.
No, but, and you know what, most of the people that I've spoken to who didn't like it were just mad at the Mandarin reveal. And I said, you know what, I like that because I didn't expect it, and it moves the story along. You know, there were people that sat in the theater waiting to see a guy shoot rings at armor. And when they didn't see that, they rejected the whole film.
Yeah, and it wasn't like, I mean, the Mandarin. It's the Mandarin. It's not like it's Dr. Doom or,
yeah, you know, and we talked about that. Like, why is the Mandarin's Iron Man's biggest villain other than stories telling me that?
Yeah.
Like, I can't point to a great Mandarin story ever.
No, he just showed up a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, he was there often. But, you know, and I always thought he was too far into magic to even fit in Iron Man's world.
Well, the thing about Iron Man is, you know, I loved Iron Man when I was a kid, but, you know, he was a second-tier character. He
right.
was a back-tier. And the movies have elevated him wonderfully. The movies have done for him what the 66 TV show did for Batman. It took him, gave him resonance, and made some of the sillier stuff make sense. And that's what they're trying to do in these movies, but they keep the heart of it. I mean, the Iron Man franchise is one of the few comic book franchises where when I watch it, I go, this is an Iron Man story.
Right.
This feels like an Iron Man story. But, you know, I can watch a Batman or a Superman movie, and this really doesn't feel like a Batman story to me.
No, and that was my problem with Dark Knight, which people seem to adore, is, to me, that's a crime thriller where one guy's in a bat suit.
Yeah, I don't mind that. I don't mind if it's a good story with Batman in it instead of being all about Batman. I mean, for my money, the best Batman movie is Die Hard 3. You've got Batman and Robin and the Riddler.
So Samuel Jackson is Robin?
Well, he's a sidekick.
I think you should commit to that. I would pay money to see Samuel Jackson as Robin. The hell with Nick Fury.
That would be good. But it's two guys. Jeremy Irons is the Riddler. He has the Riddler's modus operandi. His riddles lead you away from the crime, not to it. Mm-hmm. And simply keep the lawmakers busy while he does what he wants to do, and it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's certainly better than any
Die Hard 5.
What?
It's better than Die Hard 5.
Yeah.
Well, and I've heard all the Die Hard movies they just option stories that have nothing to do with John McClane and go, well, now that here's John McClane, so it's a Die Hard movie.
Yeah. I mean, I did a miniseries at Epic years ago called War Man that for like 15 minutes was being considered to be Die Hard 4. And it was about a 747 crashing in the Amazonian jungle, and they're just going to kind of stick John McClane on the plane.
Yeah, and it's hard to identify with that character. Although, I found it interesting, in the article that you, in Huffington Post, and again, I don't want to ask you the same questions and make you give the same answers, but you said you weren't interested in the hero's journey that much.
No.
So would you say you lean more to these more procedural, plot-driven people, where people like John McClane or James Bond or even Indiana Jones, we don't expect them to change at the end?
Yeah. I'm I see where a character needs an arc, but that when that's the whole point of the thing is the character's arc. It's like, you know, let's just tell a good story with a good guy in it. I read Hero's Journey. I was like, okay, I kind of got all this. I kind of intuited this from reading comic books.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, I was nuts for Greek and Roman mythology and Norse mythology. So it's like, yeah, I get all this. You know, this is sort of like in my bones. My problem with Hero's Journey and things like that are that they provided a template for nitwits in Hollywood who don't understand that these aren't suggestions. They take it as a roadmap.
Right, that's the only story they can tell.
Yeah, every story has been told, and this is how it was told, and so you need this, this, and this in every story. And it's like, no, you don't. So, I mean, I grew up on, John Wayne and Clint Eastwood. They started out the movie as a badass. We didn't spend 2 hours watching them become a badass.
Right. Right, and if you need to have a hero's journey, you can have the other characters in it do that.
Exactly. You know, you can have a guy, like in the old war movies, the guy who's a coward at first and then, comes through in the end. Okay, he had his arc, but, Richard Widmark or, Jimmy Stewart who were in the lead, no, they're the hero. And they started out as, a skilled badass, and they end the picture as a skilled badass.
Right. Now, would you say that's the story of your latest book, which I promised to talk about. We've been talking for about an hour.
I got to sell this damn thing. This is my money on the line.
I know. You're self-publishing. You've got to sell it so much, you've given it two titles.
Well, it's the beginning of a series. Everyone will be Bad Times something.
Okay.
So this one is Bad Times Cannibal Gold. It's a science fiction time travel thing, and it's about a scientific team. It's like a privately funded science experiment to punch a hole in time. And the first team goes back to Nevada in 100,000 years ago and run into things they didn't expect, and they get trapped there. So the team left back in our time are desperate, and they hire a group of ex-Army Rangers to go through this field into the past to rescue the scientific team. So basically, you're sending the A team back through the time tunnel to rescue everybody.
Oh, I love that idea.
And mayhem ensues. So,
is this book self-contained, or when you mean it's a series? We're not going to end on a cliffhanger in this, are we?
No, it's self-contained. There's things in there that will lead into the next book, but yeah, it's a read all on its own. It's got this huge apocalyptic ending with, you know, probably the biggest body count I've ever written.
Now, how do you, since you self-published this, this is a story you wanted to tell, you didn't want to deal with a publisher or any middlemen. What led you to self-publish?
I just wanted to write it, and my agent gave me a hard time because she said, you know, why didn't you go through Amazon Publishing, and then you'd have an editor and someone to bounce things back. And I don't want to bounce. I've been bouncing things back and forth with guys for, you know, 30 years. I just want to write this story and just write it my way, you know, and get a good proofreader, which I did, and, you know, just put it out there and see what happens. And I'll promote it on my own, and it'll sink or swim on its own, and it's all mine. You know, I don't have to share with anybody, so that if, you know, Hollywood were to come knocking, they just have me to deal with, which they like.
Yeah.
So, and it's just, you know, and then, you know, like everything else, I wrote it, and that gave me the idea for the next one, and now I'm almost done with the second one, and already have ideas for the third and fourth one, so. And I love time travel stories. I'm a total sucker for any time travel story.
Now, that's great. It's funny, because we began this conversation talking about how down to earth you were. Your stories usually are. So it's interesting that you have a central sci-fi idea in it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's also a challenge because my wife thinks that I use the wrong part of my brain when I write about time travel, and she's afraid I'm going to become schizophrenic. So,
why was there a wrong part of your brain?
So while I was writing the first one, I had to kind of hide the theme from her, what it was about.
Is she afraid you're going to use your, like, medulla and you can't use your legs anymore? Because that part of your brain's
like
now working on time travel.
Or just go, you know, running around the house speaking in tongues or something. I don't know.
But, I'd pay to see that. And I'd pay to see that with Samuel L. Jackson as your sidekick. And interpreter. The man is writing about time travel. His only line.
Oh, man.
And that,
I mean, you know, she says she can tell when I'm writing by my mood, but I managed to write a whole time travel novel without her suspecting.
Is that better or worse? Because my wife doesn't like when I'm writing. She didn't like when I was writing, and she hated it when I did stand-up.
Oh, that can be rough.
Well,
that's got to be rough to live with a person doing stand-up.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would bring every bomb home with me. She was like, why are you doing this? I'm like, because I want to be good.
Well, and, you know, and the thing is, even when it works, you're reviewing in your head. I mean, that's got to be hard. That's courage, my friend.
But now the book is officially out now, right?
Yeah. It came out last month, so it's been out like 6 weeks. And, you know, I've been all over social media pushing it.
Right, yeah. Well, that's how we decided to do this. I've actually been, you and I have talked on Facebook for a while, but I've been wanting to have you on, and I've been a little intimidated to ask, and then when you sent me a message about it, I was like, oh, great. You want to talk to me? I want to talk to you.
Intimidated.
Well, not now.
You've done stand-up. How can you be intimidated by anything?
Because you didn't know that. You know, I've read your work. It's tough.
I know how you feel, because I had to work with Russ Heath one time. Well, I had to. I wanted to. On a Punisher
story.
They
threw you in a room with him. Work with that guy.
Yeah. And it took me 3 days to work up the courage to call the guy, because he had questions about, you know, reference and things like that. So, and I'm on the phone. You know, yes, Mr. Heath. Yes. That's true. So. And Russ doesn't help, because every time I talk to him, he doesn't remember who I was from the last time.
Well, that might be good.
Okay. It's like, have we worked together before? Yeah, only like a dozen times.
Here's the book. Just look at it. There, see? It's your name and my name. Well, we're at an hour.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
quick.
Yeah, really. Anytime you want to talk, we're welcome to have another conversation. Do you ever get up to Chicago? Do you do C2E2 or Wizard World ever?
No, I don't get to very many cons. I'm going to do San Diego this year only because it's the 75th anniversary of Batman and they're paying.
They're going to have you on a panel?
Yeah, I'm going to be on some. They said you have to be on the panel and you have to do this and you have to do that. I'll work the whole weekend if you pay my hotel and, you know, plane fare.
Yeah.
You know, mostly because the only way you can do San Diego is if someone else pays, so you can get a hotel that's actually in the city.
Yeah, well, they're all booked now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you got to be in there with the block that were booked, you know, 5 years ago.
Yeah, I went once in 2008. And now that Reed Expo is getting so big that New York this year was actually bigger than San Diego. They had more people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they run C2E2, so it gets bigger every year. But the one year I went, it was just a little too much. And then my friends went the next year. It was like, oh, it's much bigger than that now.
So yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's colossal.
It's work. My kids want to go with me. I say, no, not this one. This one is work. This one is brutal.
Yeah, you'll lose them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're you know, 17 and 20.
Are they tall?
I go, well, bad, you know, because they get in free. But I'm like, no. Because it's, you know, and then the stress of the two of you wandering around. No.
Thank God. I don't know how you would have done San Diego before cell phones.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you just didn't see anybody.
Yeah, you just lost people, and you're like, all right, he's gone now.
Because you get that old, you know, yeah, I'll talk to you later, and you never see them again.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's in...
we'll have to hook up here. Yeah, one of 5 dozen hotels. I'm actually going to see this person again.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, it'll be really... I am not going to San Diego this year, but I will I will read about the panel. I'll be happy to read about the panel.
Well, we can talk about it next time.
Sure, yeah. Anytime you want to come back on. It seems like this went well for you.
Yeah, yeah. No, I enjoyed this. It was fun.
This is how I used to date as well. I would just tell the girl, you know, it seems like you're having a good time. We should do this again, shouldn't we? And she could still opt out. It's like an email. I agree.
The greatest thing in the world.
This week, Batman Arkham Origins is out. We might as well keep the Batman theme going after talking with Chuck. I am about halfway through. I am fighting Bane, which is, I think, a little past the midway point. I'm really enjoying it. I have played Arkham Asylum twice. I have played Arkham City all the way through and played the side missions. And to me, it's more of the same. The gameplay is pretty identical. The storyline feels a little different. We're dealing with all of Gotham City, not just a walled-off section as in Arkham City or just Arkham Asylum itself. And because of that, we have kind of a different feel to the villains. It's a lot more gangsters. It's a lot more crime lords and assassins. So we don't have the crazy rogues gallery that we have in the first two games. And I like that. We're dealing with characters like Deadshot now and Lady Shiva and Black Mask. And I feel like this gives it a different vibe. There's been a lot of controversy about how this game hasn't pushed the gameplay or the world building as far as Arkham City did for Arkham Asylum. I agree. It's got a lot more of the city, although it reuses Arkham City. It reuses that entire landscape and all those buildings. Which, again, I'm fine with because it makes Gotham City a little more centered and cemented in this world. And we don't have a lot of DC Easter eggs. It's a very straightforward story. Batman is in a different costume. It's set in an earlier time, but the only real difference is that the cops don't like him and shoot at him. But we don't learn a lot, and it's true. We don't have Paul Dini writing this story. We don't have Mark Hamill doing the Joker. We don't have Kevin Conroy doing Batman. So in some ways, it does feel like a step backwards. But, or really, I wouldn't even say a step backwards. I really think it's treading water. But it's more of a good thing, and more of a good thing is still good. There's a lot of rumors that Rocksteady is doing a new game, and whether or not they will be returning to the Arkham universe. There was a lot of rumors that the next one would be called Arkham World, and it would be more of a DC Universe game with the entire Justice League. That may still happen. But in the meantime, we've got Arkham Origins. And if it's just 20 more levels of a DLC of Arkham City, the way Harley Quinn's Revenge was, well, I'm okay with that. It's another month or so of gameplay and more Batman. And in my mind, you can never have too much Batman, and we have people like Chuck Dixon to thank for that. As always, you can follow me at Not On My Book. That is the Twitter handle for the podcast. Our Facebook page is growing. We are doing a lot of exclusive content there. So if you want to like that, you'll be given updates and news stories that are going on in the world of geek that we don't have time to record yet. But Other than that, you know you can find Steven Store, Chimera Comics, at 19 South LaGrange Road. And we'll be back next week. Geek Girl Chicago is coming back, and we're always glad to have her. And she's going to be talking about a lot of things going on in the area. So I think you guys want to come back for that. And we'll talk to you then.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Thank you!